What I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about our experience as an integrated health and human services department and how we've used the opportunity of health reform really to further advance our integration and interoperability work that's been happening in the department. I wanted to provide a little bit of context about Montgomery County, Maryland. We have, in the 2010 census, we're just shy of about 1 million people in our county. So we are the most populous county in Maryland, and immigration is the reason that we've had this very significant population growth, which, as you can imagine, presents some very unique challenges. For those of you who may not know, Montgomery County is perceived as the wealthiest suburb of Washington, D.C., and one of the wealthiest counties in Maryland. Right now, we're the second wealthiest county in Maryland. We are surpassed by Howard County, which is Columbia, Maryland. And the reason that we're seeing this shift in large part has to do with the demography of the county, which is shifting very significantly. Our population is becoming very diverse, and actually in the 2010 census, 31% of our population is now foreign-born, and 51% of our population is ethnic minority. So that is a very, very big shift from the very Caucasian, suburban, upper-middle-class bedroom community to Washington, D.C. that was the perception 10, 15 years ago for Montgomery County. So we've had to change very significantly. When I started 4 years ago, we were still, and I would say this because I say this to staff, we were in sort of this mid-90s mode, you know, where to still think that we're very, very current and able to meet need, but we are different. We look different. And our practice needed to really take the promise of being an integrated department, which we were 15 years ago, pulled into one department, four departments were pulled into one. We hadn't really achieved the promise of integration. What we had done was co-located, and out of that comes some efficiencies and some synergies, but not at the practice level. And what did that mean at the practice level is really more of the conversation today. Just to give you a little bit of context, we've had significant, the recession hit us very hard. Our caseloads have grown every month since fiscal year 07. And as of June 30th of this year, if you look, our food stamp caseload grew by 126% at a time when we've had vacancies, hiring freezes, abolishments, layoffs, you know, all those kinds of things. The Medicaid growth is actually a very good thing. And for the first time, actually, in many years since welfare reform happened, our town of caseload started showing an increase. And, you know, application volume is always greater. It takes about $96,000 for a family of four to live without any subsidies in Montgomery County. That tells you how expensive a county it is to live in. Affordable housing is a huge issue for us. And so when in one family where there are two parents earning, one parent loses their job, and they're still making $35,000, $40,000, they're ineligible for most federal entitlement programs, right, where the federal poverty level is what, $21,000 for a family of four. So they're ineligible for a lot of federal and state entitlement programs, but they can't make the numbers work anymore, and people are in real distress. And I keep saying, I was talking on Saturday to another group here in Georgia, and I was saying, you know, the customer base even has changed for my workers. Our staff are within a paycheck of being the people who are sitting across from them, and that presents very different challenges for who's coming in the door. And so it's been a very difficult transition, and the people who are coming in are more empowered than the chronically poor. And they know how to ask the right questions. They know how to get on the internet. They escalate from the worker all the way up to my level as the director in 30 seconds flat. They're not going through the process and waiting for someone to tell them no and here's where you can go to appeal. They're immediately saying, I'm in distress. Why aren't you helping me? It's your job. I'm a taxpayer and you need to be helping me. And so it's a very different context. And just about everywhere. So when you talk about no wrong door in our department, it means something very different now. So it's a little bit more about home energy. I don't know if y'all have heard, but the federal government's really reduced LIHEAP, and we're starting to see, we had almost a 66% reduction in our LIHEAP grant from the feds and the state this year. So it's going to affect homelessness ultimately, because we're not going to be able to keep people's utility bills and emergency evictions and things like that, you know, at the same levels of support as we did in prior years. So it's going to be a huge crisis for us. We have about 110,000 uninsured in the county, and these are people who maybe a third of them may qualify for entitlements, but we just haven't been able to get them through the paperwork process all the way through. This is largely also due to the undocumented population in our county. So we do have county programs to provide health insurance, health care, and we serve about 34,000 people between our adults in health care program, maternity partnership, which is for pregnant women, and care for kids, which is for children who don't have health insurance. So overall, what you see here is the Montgomery Cares data, 28,500. We serve another about 4,000 through the other two programs I mentioned. Our Medicaid rolls have grown, and you can see, I mean, this is good news. Look at the families and children line. We went from 39,000 to about 65,400. This is good. This is what we want. And, you know, when health reform happened, we anticipate that uninsured population number to drop from about 110 to about 35, which still is going to leave the burden on the county for the amount of people we're serving today. So county lawmakers like to say, okay, health reform's happening. How much money are we going to save? Well, not really. It's not a message that they particularly care for. So, you know, for us, there are lots of policy and practice imperatives. There are households in distress, and we should be the safety net of last resort. And what does that really mean in terms of health and human services? And we have to have an emphasis on job creation, because without self-sufficiency, we'll never get people out of that spiral that they're in. And so what does public-private partnerships look like? What does community engagement look like, community empowerment? We're spending a lot of time talking about equity. And, you know, when there's a lot of conversation about social determinants and disparities. We have sort of expanded that to also talk about what does empowerment and wealth sharing and things like that mean in our community. And then spending a lot of time talking about technology and integrating. When I started in the department, and Daniel knows this, we had about 126 different systems in place. And I have 80 different programs. And so we're not very far along. We have a plan, and we have to do this on a shoestring budget with internal resources. There's no money out there, and so we're trying to figure out how do we piece everything in. So A87 means a lot to us in our world. And this is just a quick slide about all the state departments, because we're integrated, that we touch. So you can see from aging and disability, behavioral health, children, youth, and families, public health, homelessness, community outreach, just across the state, just many, many departments that we have to play with. Similarly with the feds, lots of contact connectivity on policymaking. We really have to watch all these. And so our idea is that we'll actually put a cost allocation plan that's a multi-department cost allocation plan that will enable us to fund our technology initiative, and that we'll do one plan that touches HUD and Ag and HHS and everybody else. And so we are working on it. So from a trajectory for modernization, you know, technology is a big part of our modernization effort. I work for an elected official, so I anticipate that I have 3.5 more years. I could have more, I don't know, but at the moment I have to say whatever I'm going to do, I have to do with that sort of goal in mind as to how deep can I take the work, how far can I take it. So that's a little bit of what you see here. I wanted to share with you a few cases of the kinds of people we serve and why the health and human services connectivity becomes so important. Take the situation of a 15-year-old Latino male who's referred to our crisis center for after-school suspension. He's indicated to his counselor that he wants to commit suicide. His mother's receiving mental health services. There might be some child abuse in the family. And all of the needs of this child, this family, can be served by this department and our partners. And so if you don't have sharing of information, interoperability, integration, of programming, this very siloed service delivery, depending on the door they come in, that's what they get served for. Nobody's asking the rest of the questions. Similarly, immigration is a big issue. We have the largest tuberculosis rates in the state of Maryland, very little known fact, and in large part because of the immigrant populations that are in the county. So here's a case of a 42-year-old non-English speaking immigrant. She has tuberculosis. There is some domestic violence. She's pregnant. She has two children under the, you know, one is school age, one is preschool age. There's special needs. The housing is unstable. Again, these are not uncommon families that are walking in our door. I'm not throwing the kitchen sink at this poor woman. You know, these are typical, you know, we served about 100,000 households in 2009, 2010. And about 34,000 of those use more than three services from the department. Really makes the case for why we need to speak to each other, why we need to coordinate, why we need to integrate, and why there needs to be team-based practice within our Hoarding, aging is a huge issue for us. 17% population increase in our senior population by the year 2020. So there's a huge imperative for us to provide more comprehensive services for frail elderly and multi-generational families living together. So here's another situation that brings in child welfare, brings in health, brings in senior services, preschool age kids, you know, so 0 to 5 services, housing, because they're, you know, what are you going to do with a 90-year-old woman whose house is declared unlivable, you know? And hoarding is a very, very big issue in communities across the country. That is both a public health issue and a human services issue. This is the most easy case for folks on the public health side to read. Homeless diabetic, right? You're not going to stabilize their diabetes unless you address their homelessness. But often the homeless side and the primary care side aren't talking to each other. So we use these cases to make our tell our story wherever we go so that it makes it more real. People can understand why we're saying that bringing public health and human services together is so important. Maryland is a state that completely embraced the ACA. Our governor was completely on board from day one. He's in fact going around the circuit talking about why it's important. We took a lead very early. Our legislature, our lieutenant governor was the lead on healthcare reform coordinating activities in the state. This is a little chart that we see about all the people who are impacted by the ACA, the uninsured who want to have improved access. Strengthening of safety net clinics, the federally qualified health centers. Now, that's another challenge for us in Montgomery County. We do not meet the HIPAA MUA MUP category. We were very, very eager for the rewrite of the regulations, but they didn't make much impact, much of a difference for us. So we cannot cite, we doubt that we can expand our federally qualified health centers. We have distributed poverty, not concentrated poverty, so we're just not able to make the case for more of more FQHCs. Seniors, there's need for expanding coverage for people with insurance. You know, there are market changes that are going to happen as a result of, for the insurers, there's going to be changes. Healthcare providers are anticipating, especially if provider rates keep diminishing. It's one of our issues. We can't find Medicaid and state PAC providers sufficiently. And dentists, forget it. You know, it's such a big challenge for us to find dentists. Small businesses, communities, local governments, taxpayers, we're all involved in this conversation. What did our state do? You know, we created a coordinating council, and they looked at the exchange and insurance markets, entry into coverage, education outreach, the healthcare workforce, healthcare delivery, and public health safety net and special populations. And they came up with 16 recommendations. And out of that, there is, you know, the information exchange that we were phase one for implementation. All of our hospitals, labs, and radiology centers are already online for sharing information up to the exchange in real time and being able to see discharge, admission and discharge information. Physician practices are coming into compliance. Public health is still very weak in our state, and it's a continuous conversation. We have to, even though we make ourselves fairly visible, I think there is so much happening and so many demands. They haven't quite caught up with public health yet. Behavioral health, they outright told us that the confidentiality and privacy challenges are so great that they're not going to touch it right away, which to me is a huge missed opportunity because this is when the money is available. That's going to dry up pretty soon. So we're thinking more broadly at the local level. The safety net clinics, you know, trying to position them, they're not FQHCs, so how do you position our safety net clinics? We're serving those 28,500 through Montgomery Cares. How do we position them to take advantage of the REC grants? And some of them are, you know, charitable clinics. You remember those, right? We all have them. And how do you, with volunteer clinics and things, physicians and all those kinds of capacity issues, so how do you position them for that? And then lots of interest in our local vendor community to build and to market EHR, but there's not enough money in the system to really be able to create some kind of sustainable solution. We also passed the Health Benefit Exchange Act recently, so that created a governance board and 3 advisory committees. One is on feasibility and desirability of the exchange, particularly around market rules, and I found myself co-chairing that, and I've got to learn up a lot before I'm going to be halfway effective, but it feels good. I'll learn something new, and I'll contribute from a local department perspective. And then the Navigator programs and public information activities. Montgomery County, though, we picked 6 areas that did not touch insurance and state issues because we wanted to have our own sort of set of areas that we wanted to focus on that were about the client, the end user in the community, and not about big policy questions that the state would address. To community-based delivery systems, we really wanted to to have conversations about what the safety net would look like, how the FQHCs would play, and this whole conversation about hospitals and community benefit. We're very, very involved with our hospitals on defining community benefit. And we have started a community health improvement process in our community called Healthy Montgomery, and we're using the Healthy Communities Network platform to host our data. And we're completely supported by the hospitals because we have no public health dollars really for health planning in any big way. And so that's been really phenomenal for us, the conversation with our hospitals. The public health in the community, aging and long-term care, behavioral health, it's a very, very big issue for us. We're not able to keep up with need in mental health and substance abuse and domestic violence. So it's an issue that we're spending time on, healthcare workforce issues, of course, with our local universities. We're pulling a meeting of all our deans, social work, public health, in the fall and the winter, trying to bring them together, and nursing, to have a conversation about what this workforce conversation in our community should look like. And then, of course, with technology, our goal is to build an integrated health and human services platform, portal, record keeping, all of that together, and I'll show you that in just a second. This is our Healthy Montgomery website. If anybody's interested, the website is called healthymontgomery.org. It has both health and human services indicators, and we're using this data now to prioritize the issues that the community health level that we're going to work on. And it's going to help us, hopefully, use these indicators in land use planning. That's sort of the ultimate goal, is that we're able to use these indicators as master plans are developed to be able to say senior population is growing, we need more ambulatory care or senior centers, or 0 to 5 is growing, we need more childcare centers, quality childcare, things like that. That sort of makes the case for why we want to do land use planning. By integrating our whole system, we hope to have quicker processing of benefits, reuse of data. Everybody hears about that, put the data in one time. We were one of those communities where to finish up all the benefits that somebody was eligible for, you had to give their social security number 21 different times when we did our business process map. I mean, completely unacceptable from a customer service standpoint. And with the kind of technology capacity we have right now, it shouldn't happen. We're doing a lot of community-based organization connectivity. Our goal is we have already identified 50 sites where we can put kiosks and do eligibility, electronic eligibility, and scannable apps, and actually deploy our staff as assisters into those communities so that sometimes people will trust the nonprofit before they'll trust government. We've done our assessment of our hardware and our business process analysis. We're continuing to do the ASAs and the 2B maps. We're doing our analysis of our policy environment. We've done a ton of work in confidentiality. We have built our practices and our policies where we can actually share information enterprise-wide. And we're compliant with HIPAA and 42 CFR and child abuse statutes and domestic violence statutes. I mean, we've really done very good work in this area and trained our staff in this area, and it's really an area of strength in our department. This is one of the first hurdles. Staff don't want to share information, right? Your professional education doesn't tell you to share information. They tell you to hold your information and to make sure you protect and guard privacy. And so we've actually given them legally justifiable, defensible ways in which they can share information while still be compliant with statutory requirements and to protect privacy. Huge. This took a long time for us to get done. And staff capacity for readiness to change is a continuous challenge. I mean, a third of my staff can retire between now and the next 5 years. So that presents its own challenges. But I've been doing this way for 25 years. It's perfectly comfortable for me. We have built a confidentiality policy work. We've built a neighborhood opportunity model that does neighborhood empowerment and does grassroots work and builds it upwards. We are moving towards a no wrong door. So when you come in the door, you will be assessed for all 80 programs that whatever you may be eligible for if you need it. It doesn't have to be linear, so you don't have to come in one door and then another door. So we've built our intake tool, we've built our questionnaires in a certain way, we've built a face sheet for the department. These are all sort of foundational pieces that help us position us for the technology solution, right? I always say if I'd had the money, I would have started with technology and it would have been a bad thing. So it was good that I didn't get the money I needed, because now I've built, we've done some of the foundational work to be better ready to do the technology. We've built an integrated practice model. are all the pieces that we're testing our integration around transition age youth, because you have pregnant and parenting teens, you have children coming out of foster care, you have children in juvenile justice, youth with mental health, behavioral health issues, youth who are developmentally disabled, they all have to transition. So we picked the 16 to 24, and we're doing an enterprise-wide test on how the integrated practice would work at the frontline level, at the population, you know, at the client level, not so much at the big population health level. And so we're looking at our technology. We're working on our Common Client Index. We've started the development of it using VisionWare. We're looking at eligibility, integrating eligibility across our entire enterprise and putting it under one platform. We're waiting to see what the state's decision is going to be and then how we're going to expand using that core and build it out to the rest of the programs within the department. We're working on a portal. We've built the framework. We've identified the application that we want to use to digitize our records. And so then the data warehouse will continue to be built. So hopefully 3.5 years from now, we'll be a little bit further along on all of these fronts. This is what our technology application, you know, sort of framework would look like. There's the Common Client Index, the eligibility applications, which should be integrated, document management, and an enterprise case management. That will be an electronic health and human services record. We're not going to build just a health record, so we're going to put human services into it, pull it into it. And then there'd be the portal, and on the right-hand side, you see all the legacy systems that the state would ask us to use anyway, and then everything else is going to sit on this amazing cloud, if we can afford it. That's what I heard in the morning conversation, so I have to figure out. So this pretty much sort of wraps it up. We're looking at an integrated public-private system across health and human services. We want to do integrated intake, you know, true no wrong door from the minute the client walks in the door. It doesn't matter which door they're walking into, they get treated the exact same way with, you know, certain introductory applications. Equity is a very important value for us, and how do we apply it to our workforce and to our client base? And, you know, we're trying to engage philanthropy. It's a hard conversation. They don't necessarily want to invest in technology and in government in this way. But at least at the local level, I think there's so much energy happening at the federal and national level. It's been kind of hard to do this on a shoestring, but there's no better time for change because we're all so much under the gun and feeling so much at risk with funding. So I will stop there. Thank you.